Welcome to the world of Muscle Smoke and Mirrors, where it's all about muscle, health, history, training, nutrition, bodybuilding, and state of mind.
Hey listener, you're back with episode 50 of the World of Muscle with Randy and Tamash. Hey Randy.
Good morning, Tamash. I believe it's your birthday today.
Today it is, yes.
September 2nd, what, 1935?
You're close, 37.
37. Well, how old are you now?
Making me older.
45?
I'm 42 today.
42?
42.
Oh, I was just judging by your workout yesterday. Sorry.
I was trying to mimic you, but apparently I did it too good.
Yeah. Are you doing anything special?
I am doing something special. Probably have dinner, and I'm being taken to a massage. So I'm getting a massage tonight.
Yeah, some guy named Lars.
Hopefully. I mean, I hear Lars is pretty good.
So then you're off to Hungary next week for a while.
Yes. That's why we have 50 episodes, because that was your magic number. You wanted to get 50 out of before I left, because we probably won't be recording while I'm away for a few weeks.
No.
So this week, what are we talking about?
Our 50th and the third of the macronutrients. We did carbohydrates, we did fats, and we did two parts on fats. And today we're going to do everybody bodybuilder's favorite proteins.
Are we going to squeeze it into one episode, or are we doing two?
Well, we'll go out. And then you can decide if you're going to cut me off or not.
Okay.
But I don't think we have to go to two. But protein, like I said, it's the most common topic in bodybuilding. And when everybody thinks of protein, they always think, oh, what am I going to eat? But, you know, proteins, like carbohydrates and fats, they're also structural, very important for life itself, as we talked about in our fat episodes. The essential fatty acids were precursors to a group of what are called eicosanoids, a subset of eicosanoids called prostaglandins, which are very important hormones in our body. And proteins, next to water, I think it's proteins that are the most abundant compound in our body. And there's like fibrous or structural proteins like collagen that holds our tissues, a lot of structure of tissues together. Keratins are in the fingernails and in the hair. They're enzymes. They proteins transport. Remember with cholesterol. Remember cholesterol couldn't travel around the bloodstream unless it was wrapped in a protein layer. We would also call globular proteins. Bodybuilders are familiar with the receptor sites. The receptor sites on muscles that take up, you know, that insulin attaches to, and testosterone to take up protein and carbohydrates. Those receptors are also made of certain type of proteins.
And you mentioned essential fatty acids, and there's essential amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, right?
Well, we'll get to that. Proteins, the common component in proteins are the amino acids. There's like 500 amino acids or something like that that are known, but there's just 20 standard amino acids that are actually encoded in our genome. Nine of them are deemed essential because we cannot synthesize them in the body. They have to come from food. I've always remembered I could cite the 20 amino acids using acronyms, because back when I was reading a lot of the textbooks on nutrition, it was like, for example, there's really eight that are deemed essential, with histidine being kind of conditional. There's an acronym called TV till PM. So that's threonine, valine, right? Till is tryptophan, isoleucine, leucine, lysine, PM, TV till PM, phenylalanine, and methionine. That's how I, for years, like 30 years.
I have to clap.
Now, hang on. I don't see why. I can't read anything here. So I am going off memory. So the conditional one, histidine, is with some young children and stuff. Some people, it's you see it pop on the essentialist and off. And there's six more that are conditionally essential, which means you could have a health condition or in infancy that they might be deemed also essential. And those are arginine, cysteine, glycine, glutamine, proline, and tyrosine. And
why,
then the
now, why did you say proline when everything else is ean? So how come you didn't say proline?
Proline, just my language. Proline.
I don't know. I was curious.
Tyrosine is often affiliated with phenylalanine, which I think tyrosine can be made from phenylalanine. Tyrosine is important amino acid for the thyroid. Tyrosine and zinc, selenium, the mineral selenium, and iodine are three important compounds you might see in thyroid supplements. And the remaining five are aminos that can always be produced. They're no problem in the body when needed. And they are alanine, aspartic acid, asparagine, and let me see, glutamic acid and serine. There, all 20.
All 20. That's all 20. Impressive.
Yeah. These are like those 20, they're the 20 standard amino acids you'll find in biology, they find in the human body and out in the plants and the animals. And they're transcribed. They can be transcribed. They're in the DNA. And the sequence of the alphabet in the DNA will instruct the RNA to build these proteins. So any amino acid sequence in the DNA can be copied to RNA and go out into the cell and produce the proteins that are needed. There can be up to, like, I think I read 1 billion or 3 billion proteins in any particular cell. So it's like it's quite amazing when you look at what the numbers we're dealing with here. And the amino acids, like they have for example, like a cysteine and methionine, they're sulfur based. They're the two sulfur based, and the amino acids have they have just like fats had a carboxyl and a methyl group. The amino acids have an amine and a carboxyl, and they have a side chain that gives them identity. And amino acids will form if two amino acids form together, it becomes a peptide, a dipeptide. Then three tripeptide. Then you get into polypeptides. These are still called peptides, and they have function, but they're not considered whole proteins. And when they get up to about 20 peptides, and they can have these side chains, then they can start to take on three-dimensional configurations, and which give the protein its identity in terms of its functionality in the body. And there are actually 23 proteinogenic. That means building. They're building blocks. Of all those, like I said, there's like 500 amino acids, like 23 of them, but 20 of them, the 20 of the main standard ones are encoded in the DNA. And again, we're talking about the 9 that are essential. The body cannot synthesize them, so they have to be supplied in the body. In our food. And those are called the proteins in nature that have those 9 essential are called complete proteins. And typically, those are animal products: milk, dairy, eggs, and the non-essential are usually associated meats. The non-essentials are typically affiliated with the vegetable plant kingdom. Now, most plants and animals, even the plants and nuts and seeds, they typically have in most cases have all the essential amino acids, but they're in such low quantities that they're considered incomplete. It's typically methionine, threonine, and lysine that are lacking. So in cultures around the world, you'll see, like in Mexico, they'll mix their beans with corn because I think the corn is the methionine that's lacking in the beans. Soybeans lacking in methionine, and mixed with rice in China and other beans with rice, they can make a complete protein. And I remember this from the vegetarian days, that the vegetarians, they weren't worried about having these animal products for complete proteins. They believed in the amino acid pool, that you didn't even have to eat the beans and the corn at the same time.
And the other kind of the negative of that is, imagine you're going to get a little bit of, and I wish I could give you the exact numbers, I did not look it up, but you're getting a little bit of complete protein, but a crap load of carbs. Which is actually good for people who do well with carbs, but it's not good for people who don't do well with carbs. And I guess that's the difference between people who are okay eating a vegetarian-like diet as opposed to people who cannot thrive on them, actually.
Yeah, specifically, what are the best sources of the 9 essential amino acids? With those 9 essential, we'll say 8. It's really just 8 in the healthy adults. The body can produce all the rest that it needs. And they used to have the different ways of scoring protein, like remember biological value, the yes. And what's the protein efficiency ratio. The one that I wrote about in volume one was the protein digestibility corrected amino acid score. I said the politically corrected amino acid score because they fudged it. They fudged. They almost put limitations on milk and eggs and that so soy could be boosted up because soy, yep, it is definitely lacking in the sulfur-bearing methionine amino acid, methionine. However you want to say it, M-E-M-E-T-H-I-O-N-I-N-E. So I just, you got to remember, I spend most of my time listening to a mechanical voice speak to me. Mm-hmm. So whatever it says, it drives it into my head. So I'll come out and crucify somebody's name because I heard it spoken to me by a mechanical voice for about 5 hours or so. Right? So that soy has problems because it has what I call... It is lacking in that amino acid, and it also has what are called amino acid. It hinders amino acid production. For example, there's a in
production protein or absorption,
digestion. In, when we eat proteins, it starts in our stomach with hydrochloric acid and pepsinogens released from the stomach wall, which converts to pepsin, starts breaking down the proteins into polypeptides and not necessarily into specific amino acids yet, but then it moves into the small intestine where a trypsinogen is released and converted to trypsin and chylotrypsin is activated. Now, there are inhibitors in soy that interfere with trypsin's activity on the digestion of proteins. And also soy has binders of other compounds that bind and interfere with calcium, magnesium, and zinc. Zinc mineral absorption. So these are called anti-nutrients, and they've done a lot to try to get rid of these, but in doing so, they have to process the crap right out of soy. And that's why it's always had such a bad rap, because it's just, even in ancient times, I remember reading Sally Fallon Marianic wrote an article on the ploy on soy. They talked about even the ancient pictographs or whatever, where they illustrated certain foods with the root, the stem, and the leaves. Mm-hmm. With soy, it was always just depicted with the root. Like it was never to be. It was like something to do with the soil and healthy. It's got a lot of nutrients in it, but it's almost like a nitrogen balance fertilizer as opposed to a food. That through the centuries, different ways of fermenting it to get rid of a lot of these anti-nutrients came into play, like soy and meso and temp and stuff like that.
Miso and tempeh.
Miso, yeah, I
know that's what, but it is the miso soup that's probably the only thing worth eating that's made of beans, soybeans.
Yeah, in mass production, it was mostly an industrial product for the first 50 years for the oils and the grease and the paint. And the meal was thrown into the ground, again, for nutrition in the ground. Then they decided to start feeding it to us, right?
To people and pigs.
Yeah, so it became, and then it made its way into our food supply. But
And I believe miso soup has to be fermented, miso has to be fermented for like months in order for it to be edible by us. It's not like a two-day process.
Yeah, so that's part of the problems with the legumes, beans. They are a much more difficult digest. Like eggs, milk, typically everybody can handle in their proper raw state. Like for example, milk in its raw state, they can typically be handled by almost everybody. Right?
Yeah, could actually do a whole show on all the grains and their digestibility.
Yeah, that's sometime down the line.
Exactly. So,
but
let me just cut in there for a second, because the way I look at proteins versus carbs and fats is that they're the building block, as you mentioned earlier. And what I've noticed with female clients mostly is that they don't eat enough of them, so they're short on energy and they get sore after working out.
And anemic often.
Anemic, exactly. That's another kind of common thing, general, if we're going to generalize, because not all of them. And what I've noticed is as soon as they start eating a little more protein, the fat just melts away. It's actually, it speeds up their metabolism and they start losing body fat a lot easier than when they were not eating protein or as much of it.
Well, that's what happened with me, remember? I told you 1994, 1995. It made a huge difference.
Women have this tendency of not wanting to... Eat protein for some reason.
I found the exact same. Even when I worked as a computer programmer for years, I worked with a lot of women. I just talked to them because I was about nutrition and just curious. Some of their diets are like 90% carbs, you know, because they had their coffee, then they have their bagel or toast in the morning, muffin. Then they had their muffin. That's mid-morning, the mid-morning muffin. Then a salad, And some might have a little bit of chicken or something with it, but it's all carb. I said, man, you eat nothing but carbohydrates.
If you've ever had a salad from a fast food place with chicken on it, it has like three pieces of chicken, like thumb-sized pieces of chicken. That's like the chicken salad.
And they can, when you start eating that way for quite some time and you throw in antibiotics, you can really disrupt the internal ecosystem where it can be difficult for a bit to start digesting meat again. That's why I recommend raw, but most women, I actually have a client that does it.
Yeah. I recommend digestive enzymes.
Yeah, you can go that route. But I find that most that raw meat digests very relatively easily. But one of the, again, on that topic of not eating, wanting to eat protein, go back a bit and look at the recommendations for protein, right? Bob Hoffman wrote Better Nutrition in 1940, and he was looking at the League of Nations. The League of Nations was a predecessor to the United Nations. It came into being around the early 1920s, I think 1921. Bob wrote the book in 1939. So he was drawing from the League of Nations recommendations, you know, international recommendations for food. And at that time, I believe it was 0.45 grams per pound. Right, so because typically through our bodybuilding lives, the standard was 1 pound.
Was it 1 pound? 1 gram per pound?
That's right, 1 pound per gram. Yeah, 1 pound of protein per gram of body weight, 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, and obviously they've gone up and down from there. But even going back in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, it was quite low in that book. And today, still, they recommend 10 to 35%. I think the USDA has 50 grams per 2,000 calories. So if you go 50 grams times 4 calories, 200 calories, that's 10%, right? Mm-hmm. So they still have it quite, you know, relatively low. So if you had a bodybuilder eating 4,000 calories, that'd be 100 grams. That's certainly quite a bit of protein, really, still, but it's not considered a lot in bodybuilding standards.
And part of it is how much you actually assimilate and absorb. Right? Yeah. You could eat tons, but if you're only absorbing a fraction of it because your digestive system is out of whack, then it's just wasted.
Yeah, speaking of with Bob Hoffman, like protein in bodybuilding, it wasn't really touted as it was later on before the 1950s, because as I mentioned in Better Nutrition, Bob didn't really spout off a lot about protein. And he did have a chapter on what the champions ate, but he just talked about the guys like Graham McNeil and Stanko and who are eating just a lot of food. But the diet was high naturally in fat and protein. But there were no supplements at the time.
Exactly. Okay. There was no point in pushing protein yet.
Now, in 1950, when Irvin Johnson, a.k.a. Rio H. Blair, introduced soy protein and then milk and egg protein, the point was he was introducing protein powders into the industry. And when Hoffman realized the financial boon of all this, he rewrote Better Nutrition in 1953, and he added five or six more chapters. I sent you that list of chapters.
Yeah, I have the list of them here. One of them was, a high-protein diet may perform miracles for you. Another one was, the high-protein method of bodybuilding. Then, the high-protein method of reducing. Proteins, the builders and repairers. And the fifth one was, why a high-protein diet is more desirable. These were the chapter titles.
Those are the chapter titles. Yeah, Bob really committed. Rio Blair, Irvin Johnson, he started with soy, but he abandoned very quickly, and he went to his milk and egg. Bob married the bean. Because he had land, farmland, where he grew soy, so he had to really try to promote that as he tried to promote it as the staff of life. But most of the guys I talk to, who talk about Bob Hoffman and his soy, they all talk about the gas. And even Bob, I think he was quoted in his magazine, it can make you a little windy, right? Because the soy comes with those oligosaccharides. They're more difficult, raffinose and stuff to break down for many. I can't. I can play Carnegie Hall if you give me enough of those things. So it's another thing. So Bob stuck with soy for a long time, but he did bring in other proteins in the 50s, but he still, his high protein was soy for quite a while. But that's really when and why protein took off in bodybuilding. It was more financially driven as opposed to factual, mm-hmm. as to kind of build. Now, again, if you're eating Like Gremick and those guys, they did eat a lot of protein, but it was natural. It came with the meat and the fat. And the same when you look at guys who were working with Blair. Blair swore by the milk and egg proteins, mm-hmm. right? Where because he could sell that. Where Don was eating a lot, he was eating 2 pounds of meat.
Don Holworth, you're talking about, right?
Sorry, yeah, Don Holworth in 1967 while training for the Mr. America. 2 pounds of meat and 3 dozen eggs a day, plus a quart of raw cream. So he was up to 8,000, 9,000 calories, primarily of protein and fat and some raw milk in there. So he didn't really – he was using some of Blair's protein, but he didn't need it. At that, he's getting like hundreds of grams of natural protein. And high-protein diets have been accused of possibly causing kidney problems, but I don't believe that's a case with healthy people and whole natural proteins.
Well, now, that has been debunked already in healthy people. There are studies that show it's not – it doesn't cause anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't cause anything in healthy people. If you already have kidney problems, then it may not help it.
Yeah, my point is I've never – for many years now, I do not support protein powders. I think taking tons of protein powders can be detrimental to you long term. But I think we've talked about that.
Plus, tons of protein for long term is not good for you either, right? Like you can get fat eating too much protein.
The body will break – typically, the amino acids can be broken down to 3 carbon chains, which can be used to make glucose and fats. Fats is more difficult because remember we talked about the glycerol and the fatty acids that make up the tri? Well, the 3-carbon glycerol can be used to make carbohydrates in a pinch. But amino acids are preferable. They can be used to make carbohydrate. That's why if you're eating, taking a lot of protein and a lot of lower carbs, you're a lot of that protein is going to be converted to glucose. So it's kind of an expensive way to finance your fuel.
And everyone is kind of different. Like some people can handle more than others. Some people can't, you know, they'll get gas from too much protein.
Yeah, the bottom line is to the individual physiologies like mesomorph, endomorph, that can determine how much, how many calories.
What was the other thing that was a big thing? I think it was in the maybe 70s, 80s, where they talked about you can only digest 20 grams of protein per serving, per eating, or each time you eat.
That worked great for the bodybuilding industry because that's how they got into this many small meals a day, taking all the protein supplements.
Which is probably how that happened because at the end of the day, it turns out that the only reason it was 20 grams that it could digest is because the tube that they did the test in could only fit 20 grams of protein.
Who knows?
That was the reason.
I know many cultures only eat twice a day, and they had no problem eating 50, 100 grams of protein at one shot. Exactly. Like you look at the Samburu and the Maasai, they are like 2 gallons of raw milk a day, a pound of raw meat a day. The Eskimos, they're eating up to 3 pounds, 4 pounds of meat, both cooked and raw. In most cases, raw before our technology gave them their pots and cauldrons that they would boil stuff. But one of the controversies, too, in digestion of proteins, and they think it doesn't matter what you eat, all breaks down amino acids and blah blah blah. But no, it doesn't. Just go all down to amino acids. Some of it do, but there are dipeptides, polypeptides that are brought over the wall. And there's this belief in the alternative field that like heals like. For example, eating liver, you know, it can nourish your liver, blah blah blah. And it's believed that there are the certain larger peptides, maybe in proteins, go across that barrier. And I think there's been a study where they did trace it to there, but who knows? But that's the belief in the, you know, if you got adrenals, you know, eating adrenals and stuff. But a lot of people think it's bullshit. But I don't necessarily believe it's BS. We don't know. There's so much about food and nutrition we don't know, and that's just the standard. Yeah, fats break down into fatty acids, and glycerol, proteins break down into convert to glucose, and proteins break down into amino acids, and that's the bottom line. But they know now that it's not just amino acids that go across the intestinal barrier to the liver. It's polypeptides and stuff. So.
And it all comes down to common sense, and history kind of proves everything one way or another, right? Like we've come this far without all these fake foods that we have now, and we pretty much survived throughout all this.
Yeah.
A few thousand years.
Yeah, so basically that's proteins are, you know, they're important. They're very important. I know people, again, many of these standards are set for survival as opposed to thriving. And people have to, like I said, it's a learning process for yourself. You know what you get to learn. You can't rely on everybody to tell you generally everybody should eat this, everybody should eat that, or not this. You got to see what makes you feel good. And if you're not working out, you don't probably need a whole lot of additional protein. Yeah. But working out, I've seen it work. I've seen it work. But that's that's all we need to say today.
Do we have any updates on anything?
For an update, I'm planning on making, you and Lily can try this out when it's done. It's the ultimate bicep pull-down bar.
Okay.
It's going to be good.
Tell me more.
No, I have to show you when I'm done. I got my welder's coming back to next week, and I'm going to get him to do this bar for me. Then we'll show some pictures.
The other update then is that I'm off for a few weeks, so there will be no podcast episodes for at least a couple of weeks, maybe even three. We'll see, and we'll continue when I get back.
Yeah, maybe not the same pace, but...
Yeah, that's we'll see how that goes too.
Okay, all right.
I think that's it then, Randy. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to the World of Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors. We hope you've enjoyed the content of this episode, and we're looking forward to sharing more next time.